This is continuing coverage of the trial of Karen Reed from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
No one in the Proctor family had been in a wedding party with anyone from the Reed family. Karen Reed was a convenient outsider. She was most definitely not from Canton. So how did Michael Proctor feel about her? How did he treat somebody he was investigating at a point in time when he should have been keeping an open mind and focusing on obtaining all possible evidence so that he didn't miss anything? Well, you will learn that on the very day that John O'Keefe was found dead on Brian Albert's lawn, Michael Proctor was texting with his high school buddies about this supposedly secret investigation using his personal cell phone. He was revealing information about this investigation to his friends, assuming that nobody would ever find out what he was doing and what he was saying. And he was revealing his true thoughts about Karen Reed to his friends, not what he put in his sanitized police reports, his true feelings. To his friends, whom he trusted, and in text messages that he never thought would come into the hands of the defense in this case. Lead investigator Trooper Michael Proctor, right from the start, called Karen Reed names you would reserve only for your worst enemies. He told his friends that he hoped that she would kill herself. He told his friends that he had seized her cell phone. And you will learn that he knew he shouldn't have been accessing any content on her cell phone because he knew there would likely be attorney-client communications on between Karen and me at that time. He knew that he was supposed to wait for a search warrant or other permission from a judge in order to go through that phone. But you'll learn that he went through the phone anyway, without permission. And you'll know that he did because he told his high school buddies that he was searching her phone for nude photos of Karen Reed. And he was disappointed he hadn't found any yet. That is the professional and unbiased investigator who was chosen to lead the investigation into the death of John O'Keefe. You'll learn that one of Michael Proctor's high school friends commented to him that with a dead body on the front lawn, the homeowner in this case is surely going to catch a lot of grief. And you know what Michael Proctor's response to that was? One word. Nope. And he explained why. Michael Proctor assured his buddies that the homeowner would not catch a lot of grief because, quote, the homeowner's a Boston cop too. End quote. That one sentence, ladies and gentlemen, in Michael Proctor's own words, will explain a lot to you about how this investigation was conducted. You will be able to evaluate whether Trooper Michael Proctor treated Brian Albert and his family differently because of who they are and their relationships between his family and theirs. You will evaluate whether this investigation was on the up and up. You will decide, as a result, how valuable or worthless the prosecution's DNA evidence is or is not, in light of who controlled that evidence. You will learn that Michael Proctor's fingerprints are figuratively all over this case. His fingerprints are all over the Commonwealth's evidence. You will learn that Michael Proctor showed up at Karen Reed's parents' house in Dighton to interview her during the afternoon of January 29th, only hours after John O'Keefe's body was found dead on Brian Albert's front lawn. You'll learn that Michael Proctor had her Lexus SUV towed from her parents' home. But you'll also learn that he wrote a search warrant in which he falsified the time that he took that SUV. He swore under oath that the vehicle wasn't towed until 5:30 p.m. But you'll learn that we obtained surveillance footage that he didn't know we would get. And that surveillance footage exposed that Michael Proctor's words in that sworn affidavit or a lie. Michael Proctor had that vehicle for about 90 minutes before he claimed to have taken. And folks, you will learn that the timing is important, very important. Because when John O'Keefe was first found on Brian Albert's front lawn, the police thoroughly searched that yard for potential evidence. And it wasn't just one officer, or two, or three. There were at least four officers that searched that front lawn. And that morning was the beginning of a snowstorm, but there wasn't yet much snow on the ground when they were searching that lawn. It was light out by the time they did the search, and it was getting lighter. And during that thorough search of Brian Albert's front lawn, the number of pieces of taillight that were found by a minimum of four officers looking for evidence was zero. It was only later in the day, when the snow was really starting to accumulate, that the police miraculously started to find pieces of taillight on the property. The police only started to find pieces of taillight after Michael Proctor had seized Cameron Reed's car. They only started to find pieces of taillight after Michael Proctor had possession of her taillight. You'll learn that Trooper Michael Proctor then kept going back to the Albert residence after that day, and he claims to have kept finding pieces of taillight on multiple occasions on multiple different days. And in addition, a good week after John O'Keefe's death, Canton Police Chief Kenneth Berkowitz, an older officer on the brink of retirement with probably not the best eyesight, he supposedly was driving, happened to be driving past Brian Albert's house. And by the way, Brian Albert is someone with whom Chief Berkowitz is also good friends. And this older man allegedly spotted yet another piece of taillight from his moving vehicle. This was yet another piece of taillight that was somehow missed by the trained specialists who had previously and thoroughly searched the property. Another piece of taillight that Proctor supposedly missed in the many times he went back to the property. Michael Proctor claims that he kept finding pieces of taillight right up until February 18th of 2022, which was nearly 3 weeks after John O'Keefe was found dead on Brian Albert's lawn. You will learn that there is no competent evidence that Karen Reed's taillight shattered at Brian Albert's property in the early morning hours of January 29th of 2022. To the contrary, you'll learn that when Karen left John at Brian Albert's house, she drove back to John's house on Meadows Ave across town in Canton. At John's home, where he lived with his two adopted children, Karen was drifting in and out of sleep, but she woke up for good in a panic sometime around 4 a.m. because John hadn't come home. And that was not like him at all. He had never done that before. Karen had a sinking feeling that something was wrong. Something was seriously wrong. So she got back into her Lexus. She backed up out of the garage to leave the driveway. And when she did, the right rear taillight of her Lexus struck John's parked vehicle in the driveway, and her taillight cracked. That was the same taillight that the prosecution now claims was broken outside the Albert residence hours earlier at 12:38. But we have video evidence that the taillight was actually broken at 5 a.m., many hours after the prosecution needs that taillight to have been broken. There is, of course, no video of the taillight being broken at Brian Albert's house. You will eventually conclude that that's because the taillight was not broken there. Importantly, you will learn that there was an eyewitness who arrived at 34 Fairview after Karen got there with John O'Keefe in the early morning hours of January 29th. And that eyewitness, Brian Nagel, who's the brother of Julie Nagel, who was at the after-hours party that night. He had a clear view of Karen's SUV. Brian Nagel confirms that there was no damage to her taillight at that time. Karen was sitting in the driver's seat with her hands at 10 and 2. And Ryan Nagel confirms that while Karen was inside the car, John O'Keefe was not. John O'Keefe was also not outside the car at that time. You will ultimately conclude there's only one other place he could have been. Now, going back to that 5 a.m. video from John's driveway, you will see Karen back up her Lexus and strike John's car at about 5 a.m. when she was leaving John's house to go out to look for him. And you will know that she struck his car at 5 a.m. because you will watch that video closely. You will witness that the wheels and the hubcaps on John's car are jostled and moved by Karen's SUV. And you will conclude that that video depicts exactly when Karen's taillight was cracked, long after she dropped off John that night at 34 Fairview. And you will learn that part of the reason that Karen's Lexus hit John's car was that Karen was panicked at that time. Where is John? Why didn't he come home? What happened to him? And you will learn that she was racking her brain for what possibly could have happened. And like many of us, was worried about the worst. Did I hit him? Could I have hit him? That was what she was saying, both to herself and to other people later that morning when she went back to 34 Fairview. She couldn't think of anything else that made sense. She certainly didn't consider in a million years that someone from within the Albert home could have beaten up John and left him to die on the front lawn. Now, that was over 2 years ago. Karen didn't know then what you will learn during this trial. Karen didn't know that Brian Albert's sister-in-law, Jennifer McCabe, left the after-hours party at Brian Albert's house sometime after Karen pulled away. She didn't know that after Jennifer McCabe dropped off some people elsewhere, she returned to her own home. Karen didn't know that Jennifer McCabe climbed some stairs in her home and eventually made it into her bedroom with her cell phone. Karen didn't know that Jennifer McCabe settled in at 2:27 in the morning on January 29th, 2022, and typed a Google search that she would later delete. 2:27 in the morning was over 3 hours before John O'Keefe's body was found on Brian Albert's lawn. 2:27 was over 3 hours before anyone knew or suspected that John O'Keefe was missing or hurt or in trouble. And at 2:27 in the morning, you will learn that with no one watching her, thinking she was alone with her thoughts, not worrying that anyone would know what she was doing, Jennifer McCabe typed in the following Google search: how long to die in the cold? Now, she misspelled the first word, so the actual search was how long to die in the cold, but you'll get the point. You will ask yourself, why would somebody Google how long does it take for someone to die in the cold? Unless that person knew someone who either was in that situation or would be in that situation. You will question during this trial, who was it who actually did die in the cold at some point that night, sometime after Jen McCabe was asking Google for an answer to her question? And you'll learn that the answer to that question was John O'Keefe. The medical examiner in this case will testify that one of the causes of John O'Keefe's death was hypothermia. John O'Keefe died in part because he was left to die in the cold. Now, the Commonwealth will try to dispute the timing of that Google search. They'll try to claim that there were only two Google searches at 6:23 and 6:24 a.m. after John's body was found. But one problem for the Commonwealth will be that we have retained Richard Green, one of the leading computer forensic experts in the country. Rick Green has forensically analyzed Jennifer McCabe's phone, both manually and using every appropriate type of computer software to solve this issue. Rick Green will confirm for you that Jennifer McCabe did indeed make that search at 2:27 a.m. And another problem for the Commonwealth is that you will hear and see other evidence that will confirm that Jennifer McCabe is lying when she denies making that Google search. at 2:27 a.m. You will conclude that before she went to bed, if she went to bed that night, Jennifer McCabe wanted to know just how long it would take for someone to die in the cold. And a big question in this trial for you will be, when was John O'Keefe left to die in the cold? I expect the Commonwealth will try to persuade you that he was left there sometime around 12:30 a.m. because they're going to try to prove to you that Karen Reed hit him and that his body stayed there the entire night until first responders arrived at 6 a.m. and his body was taken to the hospital. But you will learn that there are big problems with the Commonwealth's theory of this case. You will learn that there were six people at that after-hours party at Brian Albert's house, all of whom left by the front door and would have been confronted by John O'Keefe's lifeless body on that lawn if he was actually there at that time. Those six people walked out the front door to 34 Fairview, walked to their cars either in the driveway or parked in front of the house. Brian Albert's sister-in-law, Jennifer McCabe, was there. Her husband, Matthew McCabe, was there. ATF federal agent Brian Higgins was there, who was also Brian Albert's friend. Sarah Levinson, a friend of Brian Albert Jr., was there. Julie Nagel, another friend of Brian Albert Jr., was there. And Caitlin Albert, Brian Albert's daughter, was also there. All of them leaving the residence. Each of those people left 34 Fairview in Canton, where Brian Albert lived. Each of them walked out facing the front lawn, where the Commonwealth will tell you that a 6'2", nearly 220-pound big man in dark clothing was sprawled on the front lawn when there was only a dusting of white snow on the ground. He was supposedly sprawled on that lawn, just feet from where these people were walking when they left the residence. And you will learn that not one of these people saw John O'Keefe laying. Not one. And you know who else saw no one laying outside in the early morning hours of January 29th? The snowplow driver in charge of plowing the street for the city of Canton. And this is another big problem for the Commonwealth. You will learn that Michael Proctor, here's that name again, wrote a report where he claimed that the DPW supervisor had told him that Fairview Road had not been plowed that night. Proctor's total investigation on this issue consisted of one phone call and no follow-up. He just submitted his report that simply said the road hadn't been plowed that night, and perhaps thinking that no one else would follow up either. But you'll learn that when it came to finding out the truth, it's not that Proctor couldn't find the truth. It's that he wouldn't. But fortunately, you'll learn that we would. And we did. You'll learn that within weeks after January 29th, we sent our investigator, a former Medford police officer named Paul Makowski, to the Canton DPW to try to get to the bottom of this. Paul Makowski talked to the same supervisor at the DPW, a man named Michael Trotta, whom Proctor claimed had told him that the street hadn't been plowed that night. You'll learn that Paul Makowski found out that Michael Proctor was not telling the truth. You'll learn that Michael Trotta from the DPW told Paul Makowski, our investigator, that the street was indeed plowed that night, and that the name of the plow driver was Brian Loughran. So Paul Makowski tracked down Brian Loughran. He asked Mr. Loughran if the state police or any investigators had ever spoken to him. And the answer came back, no. You will then learn what Brian Loughran had to say about what he saw and didn't see that night. And you will be shocked. Brian Loughran told Paul Makowski that he was driving a big snowplow in Canton that night. You'll learn that the nickname for it at the DPW was Frankenstein because it had a lot of spare parts and it had been around forever. Brian Loughran told Paul Makowski that when he plows the streets of Canton in Frankenstein, he's very careful. He makes sure to check not only the roads in front of him, but also the yards to the side of his plow. He makes sure not to hit a fire hydrant or a tree or an animal, or heaven forbid, a person lying in the snow. He's always on the lookout. You'll learn that Brian Loughran passed by 34 Fairview in his plow, traveling right by Brian Albert's front lawn at 2:30 in the morning. You'll learn that Brian Loughran confirms that at about 2:30, when he went by that house, John O'Keefe was not on that front lawn. So you'll learn that about 2 hours after the Commonwealth claims that Karen Reed somehow incapacitated John O'Keefe, an eyewitness confirms that not only could it not have happened, but it didn't happen. But you'll learn that Brian Loughran also provides some other troubling testimony for the Commonwealth. You'll learn that after making that pass at 2:30 in the morning and seeing no body, he showed up again at the entrance to Fairview Road, intending to make another pass down it with his plow. This time, however, at about 3:30 in the morning, he looked down the street and he saw that parked right next to Brian Albert's front lawn, right in the very area where John O'Keefe's body was later found at 6 a.m., Brian Loughran saw a Ford Edge parked on the side of the road. You will learn that the police have done zero investigation to discover whose Ford Edge that was. You'll learn that members of the Albert family drove Ford Edges. You'll learn that the police to this day claim not to know who was parked right next to the area where John O'Keefe's body was later found. You will learn that while investigators on this case, including Michael Proctor, completely ignored the snowplow driver who went right by the Albert residence, the defense not only tracked him down and interviewed him, but the plow driver actually took our investigator on a ride back past the residence to explain the precise route that he had taken on January 29th. You'll learn that some other curious things were going on in the early morning hours of January 29th. Curious things that the police in this case utterly failed to investigate. For example, after people left the after-hours party at Brian Albert's house on January 29, Brian Albert claimed that he had no contact with anyone but his wife until he was woken up in the morning. But you will learn that he was ultimately confronted by the fact that his phone records revealed that he had actually placed a phone call to ATF agent Brian Higgins, his friend, the same friend who had been at his house earlier that night. And that was at 2:22 in the morning. You'll learn that Brian Higgins called him back 17 seconds later, and they connected 22 seconds on their cell phones. You'll be asked to consider just how long 22 seconds is and what could be said and discussed during that long of a phone call. You will consider that phone call in the context of the other curious things that were going on during the early morning hours of January 29th. You will learn about the following in chronological order. 2:12 a.m., Jennifer McCabe arrives at her home. 2:22 a.m., Brian Albert calls Brian Higgins. 2:22 a.m., 17 seconds later, Higgins calls him back. And Brian Albert and Brian Higgins are on the phone together for 22 seconds. 2:23 a.m., Jennifer McCabe climbs the stairs to her bedroom. 2:27 a.m., Jennifer McCabe searches on Google, how long to die in the cold. 2:30 a.m., plow driver Brian Loughran confirms there was no body on Brian Albert's front lawn. 3:30 a.m., Brian Loughran confirms that a Ford Edge was parked right where John O'Keefe's body was later found. The Commonwealth will not be able to successfully dispute any of those facts, yet I expect that they will persist in asking you to convict Karen Reed anyway. You will learn that there are other major problems with the Commonwealth's theory. You'll learn that when John O'Keefe was found, he did not look like he had been hit by a car. You'll learn that he looked to have been attacked and beaten up. You'll learn that John O'Keefe was a large 6'2" man who, if positioned behind a Lexus SUV, would have had his torso completely exposed to the rear of that vehicle, including to the taillight. You'll learn that no part of his torso was injured. There was no bruising, no redness, no scratches, no punctures. You'll learn that his chest and hips and legs were pristine, despite the Commonwealth's contention that he was hit by a 6,000-pound vehicle. The evidence will show that what was not pristine was his right arm. You will take one look at that arm, and you will conclude that a car did not cause those injuries. The injuries to John O'Keefe's arm appear to be consistent with scratch marks and claw marks, marks that make it look as though an animal had attacked his arm. But you won't have to rely just on your common sense when you look at those photos. You'll hear from an expert forensic pathologist who is world-renowned, who has personally conducted thousands of autopsies. And he will testify that those marks are consistent with scratch and claw marks and bite marks from an animal, including a German Shepherd. You'll learn that on January 29th of 2022, Brian Albert's family dog, Chloe, was a German Shepherd. You'll learn that Brian Albert has admitted that this dog is not good around strangers. You'll learn that on January 29th of 2022, John O'Keefe would have been a stranger to that dog. And you'll learn that Chloe had been the beloved family dog for the Alberts for 7 years. The Albert family loved Chloe. But strangely, as we discuss this dog today, the Albert family doesn't have its beloved Chloe anymore. You'll learn that Brian Albert was called to testify before the grand jury regarding this matter in April of 2022, and that he did testify about his German Shepherd, Chloe, during that grand jury testimony. And you'll learn that not long after that testimony, Brian Albert and his family rehomed their beloved family dog. They gave away their family dog, and Chloe, the German Shepherd, is therefore now gone. Now, the Commonwealth will try to take your attention away from all of these troubling facts and try to persuade you not to consider their shocking lack of investigation of anyone else, not to consider John O'Keefe's injuries, not to consider the fact that multiple people left the residence and saw no body, not to consider the fact that the snowplow driver was specifically looking at 2:30 a.m. and there was no body there, not to consider the fact that two people in the house were communicating at 2:22 a.m. but denied speaking to each other for 22 seconds, and not to consider the fact that one of their witnesses who was also present at the home was unusually curious at 2:27 a.m. about how long it would take for someone to die in the cold. The Commonwealth will instead try to persuade you that Karen Reed supposedly had a motive to kill John O'Keefe because they were not getting along. You'll hear about their trip to Aruba over New Year's Eve and that Karen was upset that John had been flirting with another woman. And you will hear that Karen considered exploring her options after that trip, which led her to a get-together at one point with ATF federal agent Brian Higgins, although that never went anywhere. But you'll also hear that in January of 2022, after the Aruba trip, and not long before January 28th and 29th, John O'Keefe was making long-term plans with Karen, including a family trip with her and the kids, and also another trip with Karen and another couple for months into the future. And you'll see video of how John and Karen were interacting on the night in question. You'll see for yourself how they looked at each other from the video at the waterfall that night. Nobody who saw them that night saw anything wrong. There was nothing wrong. I mean, like any couples, occasionally they would bicker or disagree, but you will hear zero evidence of any domestic violence in that home whatsoever. John never raised a hand in anger toward Karen, and Karen never raised a hand in anger toward John. That simply wasn't who they are. You will conclude the notion that Karen Reed chose the start of a snowstorm to suddenly become violent out of the blue for the first time and intentionally kill her boyfriend by hitting him with her car and leaving him there with a house full of people inside is patently ridiculous. You will also learn that what's not ridiculous is that someone, not Karen Reed, ambushed John Oakley. Somebody probably didn't mean to kill him, but somebody went too far. You'll learn that Trooper Proctor failed to investigate motives that other people had to harm John O'Keefe. You'll learn that Proctor failed to investigate anything or anyone who was in the Albert residence that night. You'll learn that he failed to investigate the antagonistic relationship between members of the Albert family and John O'Keefe. You'll learn that apparently nobody investigates the Albert family of Canton. Remember, on day one, Trooper Proctor was asked whether the homeowner, Brian Albert, would catch a lot of grief. And Trooper Proctor himself said it. Nope. Homeowner's a Boston cop, too. So, folks, the trial is now about to start, and the witnesses are about to start testifying. On behalf of Karen Reed, I ask that you do two things during this trial. First, I ask that you pay attention to all of the evidence. The way trials work, the prosecution gets to present its case first. They conduct their direct examinations first. So we respectfully ask that you wait for us. We will get to cross-examine their witnesses, and you will find that cross-examination is the key that unlocks the truth. Wait for us. We'll be glad that you did. Second, I ask that you keep your eye on the ball. You have one job and one job only to do during this trial, and that job, quite frankly, is not to solve this case. Your only job during this trial is to determine whether the Commonwealth, the prosecution, has proven to you each and every element of the crimes they have charged. Beyond a reasonable doubt, to a moral certainty. The prosecution will fail to prove this case to a moral certainty. They will fail to prove this case beyond a reasonable doubt. You will reasonably doubt their case because their theory of the case does not make sense. You will reasonably doubt their case because Karen Reed was framed, and the evidence shows that, despite the fact that the police never, ever investigated that angle of this case at all. Because the prosecution will not prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt to a moral certainty, we will stand before you again at the end of this trial and ask that you find Karen Reed not guilty.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Giannetti.
Or may we approach you at sidebar?
Yes.
Thank you.
We're back in session. You may be seated.
Jurors, we're about to begin the evidence in this case, and I remind you, I defined for you what the evidence is and what isn't evidence. Please remember that the opening statements of lawyers are not evidence. You're about to hear the evidence starting now. So, Mr. Lally, your first witness, please.
Yes, Your Honor, the Commonwealth will call Mr. Paul O'Keefe to the stand.
Okay.
Raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear the evidence you give the court and jury in the case now and here to be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Yes, I do.
Thank you. You may take the stand.
Put this one down. This one.
Anytime you're ready, Ms. Tilelli.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon.
Could you please state your name and spell your last name for the record?
Paul O'Keefe, last name O, apostrophe, capital K, E-E-F-E.
And where do you live, sir?
I live in West Bridgewater, Massachusetts.
And how long have you lived there?
10 years.
And who, if anyone, do you live there with?
My wife, Erin, our two children.
And how old are your children?
13 and 10.
And both daughters, is that correct?
Correct.
And how long have you and your wife been together?
Together, 24 years total. Married for 17, almost.
And what is your wife's name?
Erin.
And where did you grow up?
Braintree, Massachusetts.
And what are your parents' names?
My father is John, mother is Margaret.
And did you have any siblings?
Two, yes. My sister, Kristen. And, brother John.
And what was sort of the order in age as far as the siblings?
My sister was the oldest. My brother was the middle. I'm the youngest, so my sister was 5 years older than me, and my brother was 3.5 years older than me.
And do you work, sir?
I do.
What do you do for work?
I'm in sales for a company, Simmons Industries, which is a manufacturer of plumbing products.
How long have you been doing that?
12 years now.
Does your wife work as well?
She does.
What does she do?
She's in marketing. She works for a mechanical contractor out of Randolph.
And about how long has she been doing that?
She's been with her company for a year and a half now. Before that, she had a job in working out of Boston for about 13 years.
And your brother, John, did you call him John, or was there other, like a nickname or anything else that you referred to him?
I mean, we all called him Johnny, especially if you're a family.
And what did Johnny do for work?
Boston Police.
How long was he a member of the Boston Police?
16 years.
And within the Boston Police, where specifically did he sort of work?
He started in Hyde Park, Mattapan area, which I believe is E-18, and transferred over to Dorchester, which is C-11, and then downtown Boston for the in the SOAR unit, which is the Sex Offender Registry unit.
And when was it about that he started with the Sex Offender Registry?
So after my sister had passed away in 2013, her husband passed away 2 months after that. My brother. He took on responsibility of raising our niece and nephew. And so the Boston Police, you know, to ensure that he was safe and protected, moved him to that unit in 2014.
And I'm sorry to ask you this, but your sister passed away in 2013, is that correct?
Correct.
And what did your sister Kristen pass away?
She had an aggressive brain tumor, which is called glioblastoma.
And about how much time was it between the time that she sort of received the diagnosis to pass?
5.5 months.
And you mentioned that you had a brother-in-law, Kristen's husband, is that correct?
Correct, Stephen Furbush, yes.
And when was it that he passed in relation to you?
2 months later, which was January 12th, 2014.
And they, and by they, I mean Kristen and Stephen Furbush, they had two children, is that correct?
Yes, two children, Kaylee and Patrick.
Which one is old?
Kaylee's the older. Patrick's a couple years younger than her, about 3 years.
Well, how old are they now?
Kaylee is 16 and Patrick is 13.
And you mentioned, so initially when your sister, Kristen, passed away, what was sort of the family's plan as far as Kaylee and Patrick were concerned?
Can you repeat that?
Sure.
So initially, when your sister Kristen passed away and her husband Stephen was still alive, what was sort of the initial plan as far as with reference to the children?
We were kind of in scramble mode to figure out, you know, how we were going to move forward. My wife and I had talked about having the kids come live with us. We had two small children at the time. 3 and 8 months were my children. We didn't have a, you know, large enough house to take on two other children. So my brother stepped in, moved into the house in Canton and raised them for 8 years.
And so around this time of 2013, your sister Kristen and her husband Stephen's children, about how old were they at this time that Johnny sort of took over?
Kaylee was 6, Patrick was 3.
Now, when your brother Johnny what if any sort of legal relationship did he have to your niece and nephew, Kaylee and Patrick?
He was made a legal guardian.
And where did he move from and where did he move to when he assumed that?
So he was living in Dorchester in a condo. He was living by himself, so he pretty much moved into my sister and brother-in-law's house in Canton. Lived there for, I want to say, 4 years until sold the house and bought a different house. Which is also located in Canton.
Now, the initial house that your sister Kristen and her husband Stephen lived in with Kaylee and Patrick, about how long had they been living there before your brother Johnny moved in?
They were probably there for 5 or 6 years.
Prior to that, where had your sister Kristen and either of the children lived prior to moving into that house?
Yeah, so they, Kristen and Steve, actually moved in with Johnny in Dorchester when Kaylee was just a baby. Lived with him for approximately a year before they bought their home in Canton.
Now, about you mentioned that at some point your brother bought a second house in Canton and moved in there with the kids. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Around what time was that?
I want to say 2017 or 2018 time frame.
And they lived there up and through sort of January 28th, 29th of 2022. Is that correct?
Correct.
Now, around that particular time of January 2022, about how often did you see your brother Johnny and the kids killing them?
I would say probably every other week, twice a month.
And your brother in particular, how often would you communicate with him during that time?
Communicate regularly, mostly through text messaging. You know, a couple days a week, I would say.
Now, over the course of time, you said about 8 years or so that Johnny had sort of custody of Kaylee and Patrick, correct?
Correct.
And over that course of time, about how many relationships and well, let me phrase this question first. About how many long-term relationships did your brother Johnny have with women over the course of that time? And before you get to that, if I could just ask you what your definition of long-term relationship.
Long-term relationship is, you know, over a year.
And so how many of those types of dating relationships that lasted for at least a year did your brother have during that time that he had the kids?
Two.
And who were those two individuals?
Amy Fortney and Karen Reed.
And this other individual, Amy, when about was it that your brother dated her?
Uh, 2016, 2017 time frame, I think.
And did this other woman that he dated named Amy, did she have children of her own?
Yeah, she had two sons.
Now, you mentioned two, so other than Amy, who was the other one?
Her two sons' names are Gabriel and Christian.
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
In reference to, you mentioned two women that your brother had dated for a long-term period, correct?
Yes, correct.
And one of them was the woman Amy that you were just speaking about, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And who was the second one?
Karen Reed.
And is Karen Reed someone that you had met through the course of your brother dating her?
Yes.
Clear for the record, do you see Ms. Reed in the courtroom today? Can you identify as to where she's seated or an article of clothing that she's wearing?
Yep, she is seated right there between Mr. Iannetti and Mr. Jackson.
Just ask the record to reflect the identification of the defendant by the witness.
No objection.
Yes.
Now, Mr. O'Keefe, when was it that you first met Karen?
I believe it was Mother's Day, so maybe May of 2020.
Now, prior to that, were you aware of any other time when Ms. Reed and your brother, Johnny, had dated in the past?
They dated very briefly in 2004.
And had you had occasion to meet her during that brief period where they dated in 2004?
I did not meet her back then, no.
And so the first time you met her would have been sometime in the spring of 2020, correct?
Correct.
And what was your understanding as far as when they had reconnected or gotten back together in reference to when you met her?
They reconnected. I believe my brother reached out to her in March of 2020, right at the beginning of COVID. I think he reached out to her via Facebook Messenger and then, text.
And they resumed some kind of relationship, and you had occasion to meet or see Karen Reed over the course of hanging out with your brother at various occasions, correct?
Correct, yep.
Now, about how often would you see Ms. Reed? Would it be the same, more, or less than when you saw your brother?
Almost the same, maybe a little less, if my brother was just, it was just him and I or his friends, but for the most part, he was with Karen.
And as far as your understanding, what was sort of the living arrangements with regard to Ms. Reed and your brother?
She has her own home in Mansfield, Massachusetts. She would stay at my brother's house in Canton, I would say three, maybe four nights a week.
And that would be at your brother's house with both he and your niece and nephew?
Correct.
Now, with regard to, you mentioned that they reconnected sometime around the COVID-19 pandemic. Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
And with regard to your brother and the defendant, Ms. Reed, and the children, what was sort of going on as far as school and work with regard to the pandemic, with regard to each of them?
So that was a period of time when schools were closed and kids had to do remote learning. So Kaylee and Patrick were both at home, remote learning. And my brother, didn't have a job where he can work remote. So he had to go into the office. And most of the time, Karen would be at home with the kids during the day while she worked remotely.
Now, you mentioned earlier that your brother had a legal guardianship role with regard to the children, correct?
Correct, yes.
What, if any, legal status or role did the defendant have with regard to the children?
She didn't have any.
Now, with regard to your brother and the defendant's relationship, what, if any, conversations did you have with your brother in regard to status of their relationship or any issues in their relationship?
He didn't say too much. If they were arguing, he might, give reference that they were arguing, didn't really tell me what they were arguing about, but mostly kept that stuff to himself.
What, if anything, did he mention to you as far as reasons for an argument or sort of points of contention?
He didn't like, if she'd spend a lot of money on on the kids for gifts or, you know, I know there was some arguments over, you know, what she fed them, whether it's, you know, Dunkin' Donuts or whatnot, but those things along those lines.
Now, what, if any, sort of, what if any occasions, as far as they're arguing or anything like that, did you observe personally yourself?
Yeah, I witnessed, so they had rented a house down in Cape Cod. Say that was summer of 2021. I brought my two daughters down for a couple nights, and I witnessed, you know, one intense fight between the two of them.
And as far as a fight, as you're characterizing that, was that anything physical or just verbal?
No, it was a verbal argument.
And what, if anything, was that verbal argument about?
It's hard to recall. I mean, you know, I guess like typical couples fighting, there was alcohol had been involved. I recall her complaining that, you know, he wasn't nice to her, or, you know, something to that effect. And I was kind of the referee in that entire situation.
Now, when you make reference to alcohol involved, is that one or both? Or
both.
Both your brother and the defendant?
Correct.
Now, if I could turn your attention to New Year's, and specifically New Year's Eve, going from 2021 into 2022. You recall that time?
I do.
And do you recall where you and your family were for that sort of New Year celebration?
Yeah, so I was with my wife and her family. We went to Aruba the day after Christmas in celebration of my wife's mother's 70th birthday.
Ms. Tilali, does it make sense that I give an instruction at this point? I'm going to see counsel at sidebar.
More raw courtroom coverage of the trial of Karen Reed is coming up from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Press subscribe so you don't miss a minute.